Coming up, Kim Lawton talks with Pro Football Hall of Fame quarterback Jim Kelly and his wife Jill about how faith has sustained them through the death of their son and Jim's battle with cancer. Also, friend to Sam Lazaro on retired engineers in Minnesota inventing machines to help poor people worldwide at no charge. And best-selling author and surgeon Natul Gawande on the care people need at the end of life.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. There was mourning and shock around the world this week after the German plane crash in the French Alps that was apparently caused by the co-pilot. It left no survivors. 150 people were on board, including three Americans. Special prayers and vigils were held on behalf of the victims and their families. Pope Francis expressed his sympathies in a message to the families and prayed for their strength and consolation. The Obama administration announced that Francis will visit the White House on September 23rd during his first trip to the U.S. as Pope. He's expected to address a joint meeting of Congress the next day. His other stops will include the United Nations in New York and the Catholic Church's World Meeting of Families in Philadelphia. The first major candidate in the 2016 presidential race is trying to rally religious conservatives. Senator Ted Cruz, who's a Southern Baptist, announced his candidacy this week at Liberty University, which was founded by the late Reverend Jerry Falwell. Cruz is trying to unite evangelicals and other religious conservatives who are a key GOP constituency. Those voters have been divided in recent presidential primaries. This week, Utah became the only state in the U.S. to allow death row inmates to be executed by firing squad. Governor Gary Herbert signed a law approving the method as an option if lethal injection drugs are unavailable. Critics have called the law inhumane, but Herbert and others say a backup plan is needed because of the current shortage of those drugs. We have a special report this week from the world of football. Jim Kelly is considered one of the best quarterbacks ever to have played in the NFL. He led the Buffalo Bills to several conference championships in the 1990s. Kelly and his wife, Jill, have faced a number of personal trials, including the death of their young son and Jim's battle with cancer. They tell Kim Lawton they've been sustained by their faith.
For many football fans, and especially in Buffalo, Jim Kelly is a hero. A Pro Football Hall of Fame quarterback, he played for the Buffalo Bills from 1986 to 1996. He led the team to a record four consecutive Super Bowls, and they famously lost all four. On the field, he earned a reputation for being what was termed Kelly tough.
Fans of Buffalo, I give you Jim Kelly!
But for Jim and his wife, Jill, toughness was most profoundly tested by what followed off the field, a terminally ill son, problems in their marriage, and Jim's struggle with cancer. They say their evangelical faith has given them the strength to persevere.
You know, you can be only tough so much. And I've just been very blessed that I have an open heart now, and I listen a lot more than I used to listen.
Those things that we go through that cause us to be tested or to doubt or to fear, those things make us stronger in our faith.
The Kellys met and married at the height of Jim's football career and enjoyed the celebrity that came with it. They had a daughter, Erin, and then in 1997, just a few weeks after Jim retired from the Bills, their son Hunter was born. Daughter Cameron was born in 1999. When Hunter was just 4 months old, he was diagnosed with a genetic disease called Krabbe leukodystrophy, which affects the nervous system. They were told he likely wouldn't survive to his second birthday. Both Jim and Jill had been raised Catholic, but neither was very religious. Jill says her devastation over the diagnosis sent her on a desperate spiritual search.
There was no cure, there was no treatment, there was nothing that money or celebrity could buy for Hunter. So, you know, I was like, well, who's this God that I think that I know he's there, but I don't understand him. And, you know, I've heard about him my whole life, but who is he really? And so it was Hunter's suffering that caused me to seek after God.
She became a born-again Christian.
Everything changed then. It's not something, you know, a feel-good thing. I mean, it's not like, ooh, this makes me feel better. No, I mean, life is still hard, but God is still good.
Jim says at the time, he told her not to push her new beliefs on him.
I didn't come to faith till after Hunter passed away. So for me, the mad at God, things like that, things that I probably shouldn't have been thinking. I don't know what the word is.
No, it's being real is what it is. I mean, we can get mad at God. You know?
But it is what it is. But the thing is, the old saying is God's perfect timing. Mm-hmm. And I know where I'm at now, and that's all counts.
The Kellys were determined to help Hunter live the best life possible. They launched the Hunter's Hope Foundation to promote awareness and research about the rare disease.
No one was doing anything about the disease. No one. Obviously, with Jim's platform, you know, what a blessing it is to be able to use that.
The bottom line is you want to make a difference. And we know that through not only our story, but seeing what Hunter went through, we knew we wanted to do something.
A big part of the foundation's work is supporting families affected by Krabbe. 19-year-old daughter Erin says that's been important to her.
It's just a connection that is unlike any other thing because no one else really knows. Most of my friends have never gone through something like this, so they don't know what it's like to walk that journey of watching your little brother just struggle to live every single day of his life.
In 2004, the Kellys and Hunter's Hope helped found the Hunter James Kelly Research Institute at the University of Buffalo. Through their efforts, more and more newborns are now screened for Krabbe so they can be given an umbilical cord blood transplant in the narrow window when progression of the disease can still be slowed. Beyond all medical expectations, Hunter lived until 2005 when he was 8 and a half, although he was never able to walk or talk.
God used him in so many ways. I mean, we learned patience and love, unconditional love, selflessness. I mean, all of the things that, you know, you don't learn in books and that neither of us had learned up to that point in our lives as an adult.
You know, you talk about role models. You talk about people that you admire. I admired his toughness and what he went through and how he changed my life. I know we probably wouldn't be together if it wasn't for the suffering of our son because he changed both of our lives for the good.
The Kellys have been open about experiencing marital problems. They don't speak about it in detail, but in Jill's 2010 book, Without a Word, they describe how after Hunter's death, Jim confessed he'd been unfaithful. He sought pastoral counseling and decided to embrace faith for himself.
I wanted to be able to for my two daughters to walk in that front door, and when they do, to look at their daddy with respect. I was losing all that, and I knew that if I didn't change my life, that I was going to lose everything that I worked so hard for.
During a recent appearance at Liberty University, where Erin is a student, Jim described his journey, although he admitted he's still not completely comfortable talking about it.
I don't pray to God. I talk to God, and I talk to him in a way that I don't speak Christianese like my wife does. I don't know all the verses. I don't know all the things that she says. I'm getting there.
The Kellys still live in Western New York, where they attend a large non-denominational church. They say their faith has been crucial in dealing with their latest battle. In June 2013, Jim was diagnosed with cancer of the jaw. After surgery, he was proclaimed cancer-free. But then in 2014, more cancer was discovered in his nasal cavity and more aggressive treatments followed. Jill says the family bombarded God with questions about why.
The Psalms, Job, Paul, you know, there's numerous people that are real people that ask the same questions, ask the why questions, said they'd rather not even live. This is not the end of the story and, you know, that's what God says. It's not what I'm sitting here telling you. This is what God says, and I'm choosing to believe that over my own fears, over my own doubts, over my own frustration.
Watching my dad suffer through cancer is probably the hardest thing I've ever gone through. We just have found so much strength in Christ in the midst of my father's weakness. And so, although it has been extremely hard, God has blessed us in the midst of it.
At first, Jim didn't want to go public about what they were dealing with.
I'm a private person, and I really didn't want that. But my wife said that, we need as many people praying for you as possible. And it didn't take me very long to realize she was right again.
Jim's former Bills teammates and the Western New York community have rallied around them.
People go, why do you live in Buffalo? Well, number one, people. Mm-hmm. Number two is we love the Buffalo Bills. But number three, if we want to go south for a couple weeks, we'll go south. I mean, if you want to get out of cold weather, you can do that, but you can't take the people with you.
Mm-hmm. Although Jim still has some lingering health issues, a recent MRI declared him again cancer-free. The Kellys' work with Hunter's Hope Foundation continues. The family says they still miss Hunter every day.
You know, he would be 18 years old. What would he be like? Where would he be going to college at? Would he be playing football? I'll never know those things, but I'm happy with the life that I have, and I live every day to its fullest, and I know someday, though, I will see him again.
Jill and Aaron have written a new book called Kelly Tough. The family says they're sharing their experiences in order to encourage other people going through difficult times.
If I can make a difference for kids out there, if I can make a difference for adults out there by what I'm going through, thanks the good Lord. Because I'll tell you what, all those people out there that write me letters and the emails, thank you, because you help me.
It's not, look at the Kellys. It's like, look what God has done. Look what we've gone through, but look at how God has used that. So we always point back to him. You know, we don't want, even though it's our story, it's really about the greater story.
And they say that's the real essence of being Kelly Tough. I'm Kim Lawton in Buffalo.
In Minneapolis, a group of retired engineers and other volunteers are inventing machines to help the world's poor at no charge. Their not-for-profit company is called Compatible Technology International. It might also be giving a new name to being a good neighbor, as Fred DeSam Lazaro reports.
And I promise you a perfect cake every time you bake. That's right, perfect. You be the judge. Or write General Mills, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and get your money back.
Minnesota is where the idea of making things easier in the kitchen became an industry, home of such legends as the Pillsbury Doughboy, the Jolly Green Giant, and Betty Crocker.
I guarantee a perfect cake every time you bake, cake after cake after cake.
Perfect, maybe not, but convenient and efficient, no question.
Some with nuts, some without.
And that's the idea behind this nonprofit company in St. Paul called CTI, or Compatible Technology International. Different cakes, though.
Just plain trash.
Irv Lentz is squeezing discarded peanut shells, trying to make fuel briquettes. He's 83, one of dozens of retired engineers, agronomists, and others who volunteer here. Vern Caldwell is another. He's 78.
If you want to do the cranking there,
get her up to speed.
They're working on conveniences for a very different kitchen and customer, tens of millions of subsistence farmers in poor countries.
Here are the what it looks like when it comes out. We're obviously stripping all of the florets off that contain the grain.
This hand-cranked thresher could save hours of labor and extract grain far more efficiently than the manual methods used now. This test was on stalks of pearl millet, a staple in parts of Africa.
Just blows your mind when you think how overnight we can, for instance, help their useful pearl millet from 30% to 35% to darn near 90%.
At least in theory. Over the years, they've learned some hard lessons about the reality in a Minnesota lab and that in a village in, say, Malawi. Steve Clark says they went to try out one invention in that Southern African nation.
We had this great tool here called the grinder, which we knew could grind peanuts into peanut butter very, very well. But when we got over to those countries, we found out they didn't make a lot of peanut butter.
What they needed was a peanut sheller. Diet, social traditions, gender roles all play a role in how a product is received.
Tools that are designed in a void are largely not going to be adopted. They're not going to be accepted. And therefore, the whole process of design needs to be about really understanding the context.
One device they've had some success with is a water chlorinator. Unlike those used in rich countries, this one uses no electricity or pumps. Wesley Meyer is one of few paid staffers at CTI. He heads this program in Nicaragua.
A simple device designed by an engineer based out of St. Paul. So this is just the container for the tablet. This is the actual chlorine tablet. There's five of them in here.
Dozens have been installed in remote mountainous communities in this Central American nation. The water supply in this area is mostly driven by gravity. It comes from natural streams up the mountain and flows by gravity into tanks like this one. The tiny community of Las Animas is having a CTI chlorinator installed. When it's done, the 380 residents of the village will have safe water at almost no additional cost. The device costs just $150. Its plastic pipes and chlorine tablets are available locally. Community leaders are given simple metering devices to monitor chlorine levels and instructions on changing the chlorine tablets.
We knew it wasn't potable water, and we really needed to install this system. We know that unclean water can lead to diseases like diarrhea and hepatitis.
I've had people, when we go to play bridge at the club, people will oftentimes come along, and it's about once a month a thing, and, well, how's the water system doing? And I usually put a little needle in and say, well, we could do a lot better if we had a little more money, you know.
Does that end the conversation there?
No.
CTI's annual budget is $750,000, mostly from charitable donations. But that doesn't include thousands of hours volunteers like Irv Lentz put in, pursuing the perfect pedal-powered potato slicer, grinder, or pepper shredder. Vern Cardwell did manage to come up with a peanut sheller and got to see it demonstrated in Malawi.
By hand, they can get 2 pounds of nuts shelled an hour. And with our disc peanut sheller, we can do 50 to 60 pounds of nuts an hour. And the women look at that and they're just giggling and they're all excited about this piece of equipment. And everybody wants, you'll leave it here so we can use it. And that kind of excitement is very infectious.
There's the intellectual stimulation of working with other experts, these volunteers say, and a strong moral driver of the work.
For some time now, I've realized that my neighbors are not just the folks living down the street or over a block, but they are living all around the world. They're living in Rwanda, they're living in Kenya, they're living in Senegal, they're living in Morocco, and so forth. And we need to be looking out for each other.
And to the degree to which we can create self-sufficiency and well-being for all peoples, it makes this planet a better place for everyone.
I worked almost every day fixing things, if you would, at House of Hope Church. And it finally dawned on me that the impact of what I was doing maybe hit 100 or 200 or 250 people at the church, whereas the impact here is endless in terms of the impact on people. So I'd rather switch to working here.
He's done that almost full-time for 20 years. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSamlazaro in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Now, a prominent physician on the need doctors, patients, and their families have for compassionate care at the very end of life. Best-selling author and surgeon Atul Gawande talked with us about the themes of his new book, Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. Being Mortal was the focus of a recent Frontline program on PBS.
An illness is a story for people. It's a chapter in their life. It may be, in some cases, we're talking about the last chapter in their life. And that story of what happens is how we think, it's how we breathe, it's how we live our whole life. I don't think it takes a family member facing a terminal illness to recognize that we're not handling these problems very well. Everybody has a different set of priorities besides just living longer, and they really matter in their lives, and they want us to serve them. The most reliable way to find out what people's priorities are is just to ask, and we don't ask. There is the anxiety of the doctor or any clinician, doctor, nurse, about being able to talk about these issues. I could go to the operating room and I could come out and we will have fixed a problem, and that's incredibly gratifying. When it's an unfixable problem where you're dealing with someone whose frailty is just getting worse, their chronic illness is not getting better, they're terminally ill, and you're not changing that trajectory, well, that is where you feel really incompetent. We haven't had the skills to handle those situations. In one study of cancer patients, for example, less than a third had any kind of a discussion about their goals and priorities for the end of their life. The people who had that discussion had remarkably better outcomes in terms of spending more time at home, having less suffering in the course of their care, being able to avoid dying in the hospital or in the intensive care unit if they didn't want to. Their family members had less depression and post-traumatic stress disorder 6 months after the person died. Our core values are that the priorities are health and survival. When you start saying that people have priorities besides just survival, in fact, well-being for people is bigger than just surviving and being a pulsing organism that's kept alive, then you realize that we're going to need to change from a very narrow medical viewpoint to a larger viewpoint. For my father, and I'd say for both of my parents, their Hindu faith was really important to them, especially my father, as he faced what he knew was going to be his death. People in medicine underestimate how important religion is to people. In the top three priorities that people name, being at peace with God as they face the end of life is really important to them. Much farther down on the list is living as long as possible, no matter what. Floating on that swollen Ganges River, I could not help sensing the hands of the many generations connected across time. In bringing us there, my father had helped us see that he was part of a story going back thousands of years, and so were we. We were lucky to get to hear him tell us his wishes and say his goodbyes. In having a chance to do so, he let us know he was at peace. That let us be at peace, too. After spreading my father's ashes, we floated silently for a while, letting the current take us. As the sun burned away the mist, it began warming our bones. Then we gave a signal to the boatman, and he picked up his oars. We headed back toward the shore.
Finally, on our calendar, one of the most important times of the year for Christians and Jews. Western Christians are observing Holy Week, beginning with Palm Sunday and culminating with Easter. With special services and rituals, they remember the gospel stories of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. Jews will be observing the 8-day celebration of Passover beginning Friday evening. This week, as is traditional, one of Jerusalem's chief rabbis started Passover preparations by cleaning out notes and prayers wedged inside crevices in the Western Wall. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from El Salvador, marking the 35th anniversary of the assassination of Roman Catholic Archbishop Oscar Romero. In May, Romero will be beatified, the final step before sainthood.
Quiero brevemente detenerme en cada uno de estos puntos. Romero fue un hombre de oración. Es sin duda un hombre de Dios. Y ahora que sube a los altares, la Iglesia confirma esta condición.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.